Hey, this is Sonny, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. I have not listened to this episode of the Subbeacon yet, so I don't know what's in it. I was on vacation this week, so I'm excited to listen to it along with you guys. But if you want to be ahead of the loop, ahead of me, one of the co-hosts of the show, make sure and sign up for the Patreon. Just go to subbeacon.com, and we'll get you all signed up, get you taken care of. I hear this show's very good. You know, J-Pod, great podcaster. He does 1,000 shows a week. So I was glad he could carve out some time to fill in for me to talk about In the Heights, a movie I have no interest in talking about anymore. So enjoy this episode. And I will be back this week with another episode. We're going to be talking about Wolfgang, the new documentary on Disney Plus about Wolfgang Puck. Vic is very excited. As you know, the master of gout loves his celebrity chef. So we're going to be have a lot to say there. And I will have a tuxedo update. That will make sense to you if you're a subscriber to the Patreon, because I talked a lot about tuxedos in the last episode, but not so much for people who aren't signing up. So if you want to get all these references, go to subbeacon.com, sign up for the Patreon. It's as little as a dollar a month. It's as much as $10 million a month. We could retire and just focus on this podcast full time if one of you Bezos types stepped up. So go to the Patreon, sign up. We'll have a new episode for you this week and every week forever until we're dead. That's how this works. This ad is running long. See, if you subscribed, you wouldn't have to listen to this rambling. But you do. You do have to listen to it. You don't subscribe to the Patreon. So go over there, and we'll see you there.
Once upon a time, in a faraway land called Washington Heights. Say it so it doesn't disappear.
Washington Heights!
Lights up on Washington Heights. Up at the break of day, I wake up and I got this little punk I gotta chase away. Pop the grate at the crack of dawn, sing while I wipe down the awning.
Hey y'all, good morning.
Hello, and welcome to another Subbeacon. I'm Victor Mattis along with Jonathan V. Last. And in for Sonny Bunch is the inimitable John Pod Horitz. Just a reminder, the Subbeacon is now available through Patreon. Go to subbeacon.com. You'll easily find us. Please subscribe, tell your friends. And don't forget about the Subbeacon merchandise store at tpublic.com. Gentlemen, how are we? John Pod Horitz, welcome back to the show.
I don't think this is a welcome back. I don't think I've ever done the show.
You have done it.
False.
Greyhound.
Wow,
it was so forgettable. I wasn't
Greyhound.
There. You took my spot.
Oh, right. Okay. I'm sorry. You know, guys. Seriously, I have now calculated that I do 24 hours of podcasting a month. Now, something like that, 24,
that's it.
26,
that, I was
going to
say, what about you, JVL? What is that like? That's like I thought you were going to say 24 hours a week.
It's insane. I mean, I am sick of the sound of my own voice.
Well, you know, this is the problem with being really good at something, John. People want you to do it more and more and more. You're the natural.
So, what can I tell you? This is very kind. You know, I have to tell you guys that I can't remember what pseudonym Jonathan has assigned to each of his children. So I don't know which. I can't remember all the pseudonyms. But one of the nicest things that JVL ever told me was that my podcasting voice was extraordinarily soothing to G Money as a baby, and then he would actually speak to me while you were listening to my podcast in the car or something. He would call out to me, and that's the nicest thing really that anyone has ever said to me ever about anything ever.
And when Noah would talk, he would get very angry. He'd be like, "No, I want John. This is I want John."
Poor Noah.
And I would sit there and be like, "Shut up, Noah. John is. We want John." But this is, so this is 100% true. G Money was a really bad sleeper for a long time. And we had a phase where I would get up with him at, you know, 1 in the morning, midnight, 3 in the morning, whatever, and just take him out and just drive around suburban Virginia for hours at a time. And I would just drive until I hit an intersection and turn right, no matter where I was going, in order to just keep moving, right? If there was a red light or a stop, just roll in and go right. And the only thing we would do was listen to the commentary podcast, because all he wanted was the sound of John's voice.
Oh my God. That is so sweet. You know, here's a funny thing. So what the
he's a real neocon too. He's got some very definite opinions on Israel.
It's sunk in. It's like, you know.
That's good.
Absolutely.
You need that in a youngster, because you got to get him young. Now, here's what's interesting about these two gentlemen that you have been listening to for so long. You sub Beacon Universe extended people and all of that. So I've known Vic and JVL for 20
more than 20
Vic
now.
I've known I oh, would yeah. say for 28 years maybe?
Since 1995.
No, earlier than 95.
I remember from like 95 is when I interned at the White House Writers Group.
That wasn't 95. 95 is, was it 95?
Oh, yeah, it was 95, because that's when I graduated.
All right.
And
JVL, you joined the Standard that year, or maybe a
January,
little later?
January 97.
Okay, 97. Yeah. Okay. So I've known Vic for 26 years. I've known JVL for 24 years, I guess, something like that. And so I am obviously considerably older than the two of you. I just hit 60. But here's what's interesting, and this is an interesting, because you're talking about G Money, who is now post-toddler. He's four. Okay.
Four.
So, but I had my kids late. So I have a 17-year-old, a 14-year-old, and a 10-year-old. Vic, your kids are
13 and 11.
13 and 11. And JVL, you have a
13, 11,
okay,
8, and 4.
Okay, so
we have overlap with our kids.
Parenting.
We're all the same parenting
age. Being around the same generation as parents, that's a very leveling thing. Like, either it makes you old or it makes me young. I'm not sure which. But hearing you talk about driving your kid around, or sort of thinking about all the kinds of things that I hear you guys talk about in relation to your kids, not that I have, I would say that my children are maybe the opposite of athletes. Is there such a thing as the opposite of athletes? I mean, I think my daughter could maybe throw a pitch 5 miles an hour. Like, I don't know how slowly a pitch could actually be thrown and yet still travel through the air. That would be around the speed. Now, I do have a daughter who is a rower, who is involved in crew. But my kids are not athletic, and so we don't have that much in common in that sense. But we are all parents of children and are going through this nightmarish experience of being a parent of a child in 2020 and 2021. And I don't know if it's just nightmarish because of the culture, or if it's nightmarish because it's always been nightmarish and we're just having the nightmare. I mean, I love my kids and I love being a parent and all that, but man, this has been a hard, hard 15 months. I mean, it's, you know, you guys are much more cheerful about it than I talking about it, as I hear you talk about it on a weekly basis. I certainly have felt.
I think one of the big differences, of course, John, you're in the city. You know, and I think it's a lot more, you know, in terms of space, right? But now everyone's being able to come out now. So, I mean, well, you're at the light at the end of the tunnel.
You spent a month
at
the Hamptons, right, John?
Well, I spent a little time at the beach, that's last spring. I mean, not even at the beach, but in a house. Right. Yeah, we had to sort of get out of Manhattan when you literally could not playgrounds. Right. Think about this. We're locked.
Yeah.
Yes.
Bill de Blasio locked the playgrounds
here too. here in suburban Virginia. Yeah. The local playgrounds were right. roped
were,
off.
Yeah, they were, and so basketball hoops were taken mm-hmm. down. Tennis, you know, nets mm-hmm. were removed. Like it was prison life, and so we did get away, and that was fine. And my kids actually went to school. Their schools were open all year, very heroically, in some ways. It's not that. It really was just the experience of both of social isolation, and I would say not to bring this sort of down to this kind of conversation, but you know, kids need to be together with other kids the way we need air, and they were together with other kids, but they couldn't hang out with them after school. They were all wearing masks all the time at school. And it was just awful for them. That's all. It was awful.
Yes.
And it's sad to be around it. And thank God that it's over. I have two kids in camp right now. And I thank God that they managed to get away.
JVL, what were you going to say?
Some kids. So, you know, Flash is a super social because, you know, he, like you, Victorino, is class president of every room he walks into. And little E is quite social as well. But Favorite is much more like me. And we in fact, have a birthday party for one of little E's friends tomorrow. This young girl has an older sister who is Favorite's age, and they know each other and are friendly. And so she has been invited to come over as well to go play with the older sister. And when this was expressed to Favorite, her response was, "I don't know, how many people are going to be at this party?" And we're sitting there, and I look at Shen, and I was like, that's right. That's me. And my wife said, I think there's going to be like, you know, 6 or 8 kids. And Favorite goes, "All right, I could probably handle 6 or 8 kids. But if it was going to be like 10 other kids, pass.
Overload. Just overload.
That is a woman after my own heart. Yeah. I have much the same feeling. My son, who is 10 going on 11, was nervous about going to camp. He actually had a pretty good pandemic in this sense, which is he's a creature of habit. As I say, he's not outdoorsy particularly, loves to run around with friends and stuff in the park. But so here was what his life was like. So he'd get up in the morning and he'd watch The Simpsons. He'd ask me to make waffles. So I'd make him waffles in this little waffle iron that we have. He'd eat the waffles. Then, if it wasn't a school day, around about, you know, 8 in the morning, his phone would ring, and it was one of his friends, and he would take his phone and his laptop, and then for hours, he and a circle of 3 or 4 friends would do things with Minecraft. I have no idea what on earth.
Yeah.
It is
my
like...
My son was just playing that now.
What? Are they? I don't understand. I'm hearing half the con. I don't know what this is. It is the. It's not obsession. Like he's just, but he's a creature of habit. So he kept himself entertained during the pandemic. He and his friends would do this 3-4 hours a day. They kept in connection with each other. All of that stuff. He'd have pizza. He'd have waffles. Then he'd have some more pizza. Then he'd have some more waffles. Then he'd go to bed. Then he'd wake up. This was great. This was fine. And I said, when he said, "I don't know if I want to go to camp," I'm like, "Isaac, you gotta do something different. Like we've been doing the same thing for 15 months. And he said, I'm fine with it. I'm fine with it.
What
so
sort
like
of
he
camp
had a good
this,
pandemic.
John?
It is,
is
a
it, is
Jewish,
it
a it
choir
is a camp,
camp, Jewish camp.
It is a Jewish camp.
Is it the camp from Dirty Dancing?
No, first of all, that's a hotel. Oh, that's a hotel. And if you want to know about that, you have to talk to Abe Greenwald, my colleague at Commentary. Abe, now we're really getting into bizarre, you know, trivia up here. But Abe's father booked the entertainment for the leading hotel in the Catskills.
Oh my god,
was that the Concord?
I was going to ask if it was
the
Gross
Concord.
Singers.
No, yeah. Grossinger's was like the fanciest. The Concord was the show busiest.
Oh.
And Abe's dad, we're going to get into musicals,
wow,
and stuff. Abe's, yeah, dad, yeah, booked the actual the Concord. Buddy Hackett was at his,
oh,
bar mitzvah.
Man.
Was at,
oh,
his, yeah, bar mitzvah.
Oh, done.
Okay. And his uncle, his father's brother, was a dancer, actor, and choreographer named Michael Kidd. We're talking about musicals later. Michael Kidd choreographed Guys and Dolls on Broadway and starred in a Gene Kelly musical, co-starred with Gene Kelly in a movie called It's Always Fair Weather, which is one of the great underrated musicals of the 1950s and the great MGM musical tradition. So you're talking to the, so this is not the camp,
okay,
that my kids go to.
No, okay,
my kids actually go to a camp in North Central Wisconsin.
Wow.
A Jewish camp in North Central Wisconsin. And here's the great story about that, and then I'm going to stop being dominating the conversation. Here's the story. In 1948, the camp was founded in 1948. My father-in-law, my wife's father, went there from Chicago as a counselor. And at the camp was a 16-year-old camper named Bobby Roberta, who became subsequently my wife's mother. And so he was a counselor, she was a camper. In 1949, Bert, my father-in-law, was a counselor. And in the room next to him, sharing a sleeping porch, because people slept there, you know, in case it was too hot, there was a counselor, dramatics counselor, who had come from New York, from the Jewish Theological Seminary, by the name of Norman Podhoretz. So Bert Cohen, my father-in-law, and my father were counselors at this camp together in 1949.
And that is insane.
Then, 10 years later, my father-in-law started running the camp. That was his profession. He was the director of Camp Ramah. Then in 1973, he became the national director of Camp Ramah. My wife, her brother, and her sister were all campers and counselors at Camp Ramah in Wisconsin. My brother-in-law's nephew, Joe, was a camper at Camp Ramah in Wisconsin for 7 or 8 years. And my own kids have gone there since. So this is the camp that my kids go to. And not to get even weirder, and this is the final weird detail I'll share with you, there is another Jewish camp in central Wisconsin, about 2 hours away, called Herzl. And Herzl was founded by my maternal grandparents, Harry and Rose Rosenthal, who were leading Jewish Zionists in St. Paul, Minnesota, which is where my mother is from.
Was it named after Theodore?
It was named after Phil.
Oh.
Phil Herzl, who was the entertainment director at the Neville, another hotel in the Catskills. Oh, yes, yeah. It was named after Theodore Herzl. Thank you very much. Anyway, my mother's parents started a camp in a Jewish Zionist summer camp in central Wisconsin that I attended for one absolutely horrible summer in 1972. That I will never forget because I hated it so much.
Are you telling me that your camp experience was not like Jewish meatballs? Is that what you're saying?
Meatballs. Now, wait. I went to the camp in meatballs.
Come on. Oh, no, you did it.
This is absolutely true. Meatballs was filmed. The first camp that I was sent to was in northern Ontario. Because, of course, that's where you send a kid from Manhattan. Is to a camp in northern Ontario called White Pine, and they filmed Meatballs at Camp White Pine in Halliburton, Ontario. So thank you for bringing that
up. You're welcome. I'm glad to tie it all in.
Now, please, gentlemen, have a conversation about Vic's gout and stuff while I take a breather.
I wanted to know what I assume that your cabin mate was Chris Makepeace. Was that was the kid, wasn't it?
Yes, Chris Makepeace Chris Makepeace, yeah. And yeah, now my very close friend Dan Cassa, a Canadian, went to another camp in Canada called Tamaqua, and Tamaqua is where they filmed the insane summer camp film Indian Summer from the early 90s.
Yes,
which is a if you remember, these campers come back to the camp, and Alan Arkin is the camp director, and they were all campers at the camp, and they're all sort of come back together. Only they're about 25 years apart in age. Like, I don't know, one of them.
It's my kind of camp.
No.
This
movie is so crazy because they're all supposed to have been at camp at the same time, but like one of them is like 60, oh, right. One of them, like, is 20.
Yeah.
You know, it's like whoever they could get to agree to go to this horrible, godforsaken place in Ontario in October in the freezing cold and go swim in the lake and stuff like that. Anyway, but that's where my friend Dan Cass, and that is the end of the summer camp story.
Thank you, John.
You're welcome. How's your gout?
Oh, my gout. It's touch and go. It's touch and go, and it really has to do with the beer. So I'm laying off the beer, drinking lots of water. But don't worry, I won't have to interrupt the show because I have my Motorman's friend with me. So it's just you'll never know. I'll just look like I'm deep in thought. And but it's been fine, and I think I'm just trying to counteract it with running. And I ran a personal best yesterday, 8.5 miles. Which I've never done.
Hey,
you know but I know it's crazy.
That's insane.
It's insane. It's insane for JVL. I'm like a third of the way there, JVL. But
Victorino, you are gonna do a marathon.
Don't say this because I know my brother-in-law is gonna listen to this and he's like, okay, it's done. The only thing I thought of is I'm
8.5 right now. And how'd you feel at the end of it? You're tired.
Fine. I was.
You didn't feel wrecked, right?
No. It's weird. I got new shoes. It was great. Sometimes it feels, because sometimes your legs just feel like cement, but it's not. The breathing has never been a problem. So that's always, I think, the chest pains have never been a problem. So that's a good sign. But knees, you know, I don't know. All I thought is I'm about 1.5 miles away from like qualifying for like an Army 10 miler or something, which would be kind of fun. But
all right. So the Marine Corps Marathon is the marathon that you'll run because A, it's local to you. B, it's the best beginner marathon in the country. And C, it's still just awesome.
But it's 26 miles. And I don't want the things to happen to my body that you mentioned happen to the body.
No, you just get on the metro. Like Rosie Ruiz, you just get on the metro. That's
is that what she did?
Yeah. Don't you know that
the great New York City marathon story is
that they sort of figured out that she had won because she took the subway.
She took the subway.
Nobody is gonna like know that you took the subway. Just get get on and go.
You have an RFID chip on your shoe, and it's
different now. It's different now.
It's
you
different
can't
really.
The way you used to
Are you serious?
Yeah. No.
Actually have a chip?
Everybody has a chip on their shoe, and that's how you get your splits, because you are chipped through every mile mark, which lets you know how fast you're going, right? And will let you see, did you accelerate, did you decelerate, and helps people who are watching remotely to keep track of where you are on the course. It's great.
Is this Bill Gates's? Did Bill Gates make this chip?
No, everyone who got vaccinated, they now know how fast you run.
Can he like slow your heart rate down remotely?
Yes.
But have you been reading about this stuff about how people's thermostats in Texas, they are now convinced that after they announced that they were having these brownouts, or they were worried about that, like, remotely people's thermostats were being turned up so that the air conditioning wouldn't go on?
Like, lots of places have that.
That's not
right. There'll be a governor where, you know, but typically it's not at the thermostat level. It's down, like here in Virginia, they have it for, you know, the electric company has it at the hot water heater. And so it's just a way for them to, if there is a real power shortage, to, you know, basically slap an engine governor onto, you know, a little part of your power consumption.
What about the story about how if you own a Tesla, they can control how fast you drive from Tesla
terrible.
Central?
I'm telling you,
do you know that? So Teslas are jammed, packed full of cameras, most of which are on the exterior. There is a Tesla camera that is pointed right down at your face while you're driving.
What is it doing?
It's mapping your face so that they can they can deep fake you.
No, I mean,
or
like
whatever they need example, to, they can put you into they can put you into a cop video.
It's disturbing because, it's, for example, like the new Subarus, because I gotta get it. My lease is coming up. The new Subarus, you know, they have that the camera that's watching you. So in case you doze off or you look distracted, it beeps at you so that you have to, you know, stay focused.
Yeah, I believe the Tesla camera is probably there to give them legal cover for accidents that happen when you are using the autopilot function.
Ah.
Because well,
but
you can
but then they get to see what they're doing
Tesla,
when they're not driving, which is
well,
probably bad news.
The car did it, and Tesla can say, actually, we have video.
Of you?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, listen, Victorian, I just want to say very quickly, at the level you're at, you could probably, so the Marine Corps Marathon is last week of October, first week of November. Mm-hmm. You could probably, you won't be able to do this year's.
Mm-mm.
I don't think you'd be able to be ready for it. But if you were to start seriously training for it next year, call it March. But if you want to be safe, you know, February.
I think you could totally
run it, and you probably would not. You probably would not change your running regimen all that much.
Really,
I don't know. Big
it's crazy.
Thing you got to do is you got to do one long run a week.
Yeah, yeah.
So you do your normal running, but then
define the one long run. What is the one long run?
So much time.
My complaint about running is it's such a time suck. It's a time suck because I'm like, oh, I'm going to be gone for the next hour and a half. And that's a lot of time.
It is a lot of time. So,
John's head
is
about, it's like,
no. Have you run marathons?
I've run a marathon. So during the week, you run 4 to 6 miles, you know, like you do normally. And then on the weekend, you build. So, you know, on week one, say your long run would be 6 miles, week two, 7 miles, week three, 8 miles, week four,
nine.
You winch it back.
Oh my
God. You go all the way back and, you know, as a recovery. Yeah. Then on the next cycle. And so what you're doing is you're doing it in 4 week cycles, and you are just slowly extending the range at which your body is able to handle
I don't want to be like those guys though, you know, and you'll be fine. I got you're gonna put those white squirts in your mouth. You know what I'm talking about. John, no, John's laughing. You know what I'm talking about. That stuff. I don't need that stuff. I don't want to, that's too,
you know,
crazy
what, the,
now.
The thing is, if you're running 8.5 miles now, it's not gonna be enough for you. The bug is going to come for you sooner or later. So do it.
I know, but I mean, this is such a time suck. Okay. We'll get to this.
I'm sorry. You work at the Washington Free Beacon. You're doing okay.
JVL, what's going with you? What's going on with you?
Nothing. I want to talk about the show. I feel like we have a lot to talk about.
Do you want me to, let me do my fake transition. Let me do my transition then. Okay. Which is, I was going to talk about going to a diner for Father's Day and the kids came with us. We had a whole family on Father's Day go up on Sunday morning. I made the family go to church on Saturday night so to make sure that we got a table at Bob and Edith's on Lee Highway. And we did,
Bob
and Edith's, they have a new location. They have a new location around the corner. So we went there and I had, it was great. I had a special called the Breakfast Sampler, which is,
Scrapple? Is there Scrapple?
I had the Scrapple, John. Okay. I did. Thank I had God. Scrapple, okay. And it was good. But the sampler itself was 2 eggs, 2 pancakes, 2 bacon, a sausage patty, and hash browns, which is just a little taste of almost everything. But I'll tell you what's weird, because you know, now everyone's going back to the diner, and it feels so awkward to, like, when you have families standing around waiting for, and you've probably, I'm sure you've been like, this happened, I think, when I was at Junior's Cheesecake in New York, and people, or tourists, are standing over your table. What are you going to get done? What do you do? What do you do?
You ignore them and you slow down. You slow. That's all you can do.
I try no eye contact. I said, don't look. I said, kids, don't look at them. Don't look. Uh-huh.
But, so Abominius is the only place I think I ever saw outside of Pennsylvania. I've ever seen Scrapple.
I was curious, so I ordered
it. It's a Philly what? Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a Pennsylvania thing. Dutch-ish.
Yeah. Yeah. Tails and anuses.
Do you, John, really quickly, do you have a favorite diner in New York? Where do you like to go?
It's funny because when I was growing up in Manhattan in the 70s and 80s, all of my friends, we all had a sort of like New Jersey politicians. Everybody had their diner, and it was sort of like whether it was like this. There was a Curb Your Enthusiasm episode where there's this whole controversy over whether or not Larry David is going to go to Jason Alexander's office or Jason Alexander is going to go to Larry David's office or something like that. It was always like, come to my come to my diner.
So territorial,
like,
you know, yeah.
It was So my diner was the Olympia, which was a block from my house. Like I had friends who were at the. Who were at the Olympia diner. There was another, there are various diners. Of course, there is a legendary diner also called the Olympia Diner in New York, legendary to the three of us because it is where the conversation that incepted the Weekly Standard took place between me, Bill Kristol, and Dan Cass in October of 1994. My favorite diner is actually in Brooklyn Heights. It's a place called Clark's in Brooklyn Heights, and it is easily the best diner in the United States based on my experience. But it's not a diner like it. It's not a train car, you know. It's a New York City diner.
It's a New York City diner, like a Goodfellas diner.
Yeah,
style,
like yeah. And you guys,
what makes
of course,
it so great.
Just the food is really good. They have fantastic like friendly wait staff. You know, it's one of those places where I went there a lot when I lived in Brooklyn Heights, and then I moved like 15, 16 years ago. If I walked in the door now, they would say, John, how are you? And then they would remember what I ate. And then they would say, do you want the cheese omelet or not? You know, like that. It's one of those places, and it's great. And it's right near the Brooklyn Courthouse, so it's a place where lawyers lawyers hang out while they're waiting for, you know, court and stuff like that. So it's a great place, and I recommend it very highly. Of course, if you haven't seen the single greatest 21st century sketch from SNL, there is a sketch called Diner Lobster that John Mulaney wrote and starred in when he guest hosted on the show a couple of years ago, which is, you know, deals with the fact that diners have these 17 page menus. And as you may know, like there's every dish.
No, you can get lobster tails. Yeah. 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 Right. You can get anything.
Anyway. So somebody orders in the sketch, somebody orders the lobster from the diner menu. And it's actually very fitting because it turns into a full-scale production number based on Les Miserables. And so if you haven't seen it, go look it up. Diner Lobster, it is. People are always
Thank
talking
you very
about
much.
The problems
we'll,
of this.
We'll
and
do.
It's the greatest of, we'll all, do. Of all sketches.
And the diner that you like, what is it called again? Your favorite?
Clark's.
Clark's. And it's where is it?
It's in Brooklyn Heights.
Speaking of the Heights, this week we're talking about In the Heights.
Whoa!
Thank you. Over on HBO Max. John, normally our friend Sonny Bunch would give a movie review. I could only imagine what he would say about this. Would you like to give our listeners just a general sense of what this movie is about?
Sure. So In the Heights is about a corner in the neighborhood of Washington Heights, which is in northern Manhattan. A neighborhood dominated by Dominicans, you know, sort of immigrants from the Dominican Republic. And on this corner, there are three businesses. There is a bodega, a small sort of like a grocery store run by our hero Usnavi, who is a Dominican immigrant who is longing to return to the Dominican Republic, closes bodega and open a bar on the beach. On the next to him, or on the other corner, is the livery cab company, the sort of private cab company run by a Puerto Rican immigrant played by Jimmy Smits, whose name I can't quite remember, who has a daughter who is the pride and joy of his family, who has gone off to Stanford. And on the other corner is a beauty salon run by probably a Mexican immigrant, though it's never quite specified, a woman and her sidekicks, one who does nails, one who does hair. And it's basically these three businesses. Usnavi is in love with one of the hairdressers. Nina, the daughter of the livery cab, is in love or is loved by the livery cab company's employee, Benny. And hijinks, very plotless hijinks ensue over the course of a hot summer in Manhattan. These two love affair, there's a blackout, there's a heat wave, there's a blackout during the heat wave. And then the question, and there's a lottery ticket that is sold at Usnavi's bodega that has a $96,000 payoff, and nobody knows who's won, but this lottery ticket may fulfill all of their dreams depending on who gets the lottery ticket. The plot's the worst part of the movie. The show, it's based on a Broadway musical from 2008, written by the very young Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote the music and lyrics and came up with the storyline, though somebody else wrote the book. The plot there wasn't great either. The plot in the movie is distended and complicated and confused because they decided to add a whole subplot about dreamers and a protest about dreamers, and the conflicts don't make very much sense because they moved around the whole question of who won the lottery ticket and when to later in the movie. And so that is the central drama in the show, and it's not really present in the movie. So you don't see the movie for the plot. You see it for the numbers and the performances and the photography and all of that. And I adore this movie. I have to confess to a rooting interest in it because its producer, one of its producers, is a very dear friend of mine. Having said that, I adored it anyway. He's made some other movies I haven't liked, so I can tell you that I don't like everything that he produces. But it is a musicals are about their number, are about the numbers. Really great movies always have to have an involving plot that draws you in and has a conflict that you worry about the resolution of. And as I say, In the Heights is much more like a Shaggy Dog story that doesn't really have a beginning or an end that much. But it has five or six really fantastic production numbers, all of which are, you know, Latin inflected, obviously. And if you... Sonny can't bear to see anybody dance or sing because he hates joy and fun and only likes violence and death.
Very fair.
And like that. But, you know, I was thinking about this because, of course, this weekend the new Fast and Furious movie opens. And these are movies the way Sonny says he doesn't understand musicals, I've seen six or seven of these movies. I do not understand why people love this franchise at all. I don't get it. I don't understand why people like to see cars flying through the air.
Because they're about family.
And driving on.
It's all about family.
Yeah,
the flying cars are really a metaphor for family.
Okay. So, but here's why I wanted to mention this, because the structure of the modern action movie, a lot of these modern action movies, the structure of them has been taken, lifted directly from the American musical, right? They are sequence driven, and there is a production number, every 10 or 12 minutes. That is how a classic from Lethal Weapon on, right? It's like the producer Joel Silver, who made Lethal Weapon, called them whammos. Like, these scenes, you sort of like have dialogue and stuff going on that's sort of funny where someone makes dinner. And then you have some big chase scene. Then you have another scene or something or other where, you know, Mel Gibson is in his trailer thinking about killing himself. And then you have another scene where cars fly through the air and people chase each other or something like that. That is exactly the structure of a musical. A musical is a series of sequences, of popping sequences that punctuate a plot or emerge from the plot and then have these like wild valences. And so I don't understand why Sonny hates musicals if he loves these kind of movies so much, because it's exactly the same structure. Yeah. And it's just as ridiculous that a car flies through the air, lands, and can continue to drive, when if I'm driving along and I hit a pothole, my car has to go into the shop for a week. But if you're in Lethal Weapon and a car flies off a bridge 40 feet, lands on the other side of the bridge.
It'll land upright.
Flips over, and then you can keep driving.
Yeah.
Instead of it. Okay. So that's no less ridiculous than someone starting to sing. Okay.
Wow. JVL, you liked this show as well, didn't you? You loved this show. So.
I mean, look, for a filmed version of a Broadway musical that is 7 hours long without an intermission, I thought it moved pretty well. I mean, it didn't feel a minute over 3 hours and 15 minutes.
What did I text you? Remember I texted you? I asked.
Will this movie ever end?
And you said, never.
No, it never does. So I have so many questions. First of which, John, is did you see it in the theater on Broadway, like in the actual theater? Did you see it back in 2008?
Okay, oddly enough, I saw it in the theater, but I saw it in London years later in a weird theater in London with, you know, British actors desperately trying to do New York accents. So, and I really enjoyed it there too, but much of it had a slightly community theater production feel, as though, you know, if you were in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and you had people trying to sound like they were from, you know, Bosnia, like it's, you know. Anyway.
So not in the West End. So
John, I take it you were bored, is what you're saying. And Vic were both extremely bored by In the Heights.
I was bored. I didn't like it. I'm not a musical guy. I don't carry the hatred for musicals that Sonny does. But a musical has to be I can't appreciate your Mendoza line musical. It does not mean it has to be really good to get me. Mm-hmm. And this didn't strike me as really good. It didn't strike me as bad. I mean, there are many things in it that you think to yourself, oh, that's kind of nice, right? I mean, it does have a certain energy to it. Things that I don't quite understand, like the big swimming pool sequence, which, by the way, going to a public pool in New York City is my vision of hell. I don't even like going to the little tiny swimming pool at our beach house. If there are two other people in it,
right.
I don't You're like out. Being in that.
You're not
I'm
going
like,
in there. Right. For the beach.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, at the beach, if there are people in the ocean with me at the same time, I'm a little, you know, like if they're closer than 50 yards, I'm a little But
right.
So that sequence, right? And so we get the Busby Berkeley thing, right? But the editing of it is cut so quickly that I feel like we never really get to see the choreography because we're moving on to the next thing so quickly. So here's the, I have many, many questions for you, John, but one of which is this. My single biggest takeaway for this is that America and the world of art dodged a bullet by having Hamilton released as a stage production to video rather than as a movie, a movie-fied version of the stage production. because the original cast Disney Plus version of Hamilton, which came out, is, I don't know, the single greatest thing ever made. Mm-hmm. Absolutely the top, I would say the best musical ever made, but John, you would probably call it like top two, right? And I worry that had that been turned into a filmed theatrical version, like the way mm-hmm. the Hugh Jackman Les Mis was or something like that, mm-hmm. it would have been absolutely butchered mm-hmm. as an experience. So I wonder if this is, all of which is yeah, to get at, is that the case here? Would we have been better off with an original cast version of this where the film is the stage right. production of it?
Probably not. I mean, again, I think that they got this idea that they needed to make this. So in 2008, the story of In the Heights is, here are all these immigrants, and they all have a dream, and one of them dreams of going back to the Dominican Republic. One of them dreams of paying of his daughter becoming a star at Stanford. One of them dreams of opening a nicer hair salon, and they don't need that much money to do this, or what we would consider a lot of money. It's $96,000, and who's going to get it, and whose dream is going to be fulfilled? And the central thing, and this is both true of the movie and the show, just as is true of Hamilton, and one of the reasons that the political controversy that has arisen from In the Heights is so interesting to me and so horrifying, is that the story is Usnavi, our hero, who is literally named for the U.S. Navy. His father sees a ship mm-hmm. as he is coming into New York Harbor that says U.S. Navy, and he names his son Usnavi. U.S. Navy.
He's a neocon.
He
likes force projection.
Right. He wants to go back to the island that he grew up. He grew up in the Dominican Republic. He was 8 when he comes to New York. He wants to go back. His father has died. He wants to go back to his home. And the whole story of In the Heights is about Usnavi realizing that he lives on an island, that the island is Manhattan, and that Manhattan is his home. And Manhattan is also the home of this Puerto Rican family that has come from Puerto Rico, and these women who work in the beauty salon. They are all Spanish-speaking, Latino, Hispanic, whatever you want to call them. And this is
Latinx,
their city.
John, the term we use on this show is Latinx.
Okay,
Latinx.
Fine.
Or yeah, Latinx.
Latinx. Latinx. And the whole story is, this is their home. America is their home. New York is their home, and America is their home. And in the big number, the great number in the movie too, Carnival del Barrio, where there's a heat wave, and everyone's like lolling around in the street, and the woman who runs a beauty salon says, "What's the matter with all you people? Let's all dance and sing. Like, let's have a carnival here, because since when are Latin people afraid of heat?" And everybody takes out a flag, like different nationalities. The Puerto Ricanos take out the Puerto Rican flag. Mm-hmm. The Mexicans take out a Mexican flag. The Dominicans
Cubans.
Take out a Dominican flag. Mm-hmm. The Cubans have a flag. Mm-hmm. And they all dance and they sing and they do this whole thing. And one of them says, "I'm my father's from PR. My mother's from Chile. And the Dominican Republic, which means I'm Puerto Chileno Eurican, mm-hmm. but I just say I'm from Queens." This whole movie, just like Hamilton, is an immigrant, is an American, is a up with people, optimistic story about people finding their way in America, the land of the free and the home of the brave. Just as Hamilton, which is Lin-Manuel Miranda's masterpiece and is probably the greatest work of American popular art, certainly of the 21st century so far, is a story about how America, the story of America, is everyone's story. That's why it's done in rap. Hamilton is Puerto Rican, like Lin-Manuel Miranda. George Washington is black. Aaron Burr is black. The Schuyler sisters are black and Latino. There's a reason for that, and it's not just to be cutesy or multicultural. It is, this is our story. This is everyone's story. This is the American story. And this is so out of phase with our Black Lives Matter, identity politics, 1619 mm-hmm. Project America is Evil culture, that this movie comes out, and what is the attack on it? The attack on it is that it makes invisible Afro-Latinos. That is to say, people yeah. with dark skin from Spanish-speaking countries, and they're made invisible in the movie because they didn't cast an Afro-Latino in one of the leading roles. So we're now taking a movie that is a celebration of Latino culture, most broadly speaking, Dominican, Puerto Rican, Chilean, mm-hmm. Mexican, blah, 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 and it's not good enough. It's not sliced and diced enough. It's not colored enough. It's not enough because nothing could yes. ever be enough.
Right. That's right.
And so I feel very defensive of it simply because this guy is fantastic. This guy, Lin-Manuel Miranda, is 41 years old. You know, he's the son of a New York City political consultant. He goes to Wesleyan. He writes a musical. He gets it on Broadway. He then writes this just astounding masterpiece of a thing. It's on Broadway. It's the greatest thing ever. Everybody loves it. Nobody doesn't love it. He's got a delightful personality. He's a charming person. He makes a celebration and salute to his neighborhood, to his culture, to his American melting pot culture. And what happens when this movie is made and comes out? He gets crapped on. He is the greatest ambassador of the idea that Latinos are fully American who has ever lived. And his own people or these people crap on him. And it just makes me so angry that I can't even stand it.
And he apologized too.
Well, you know, because like, what are you supposed, what he said was, I'm learning. Rita Moreno, who was the first Puerto Rican, you know, won an Oscar for West Side Story.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1961, and Lin-Manuel Miranda produced a documentary about her. She goes on Stephen Colbert and she says, she's 89 years old, and she says, "Lay off. He's the greatest thing that's ever happened to us. Mm-hmm. What is the matter with all you people? Nobody is ever satisfied with anything," she says.
Yeah, there you go.
And then 16 hours later, she's like, "I've never been more ashamed of myself.
Oh.
I understand that people were made to feel invisible." And that's terrible. It's a terrible thing. And it's just so awful.
Re-education is quick.
Right. Why did so she do that? Okay, I'm going to just quickly explain to you why she did that. She's in the new version of West Side Story that Steven Spielberg has made, which is coming out in December. And she is also an executive producer of West Side Story. And Spielberg said to her, "You better get out there and apologize. Mm. We can't have any controversy regarding this because I want to win an Oscar for this movie," which, by the way, is never going to happen. You want to know why? Let's talk about West Side Story. Again, one of the great things ever, right? Won an Oscar as a movie in 1961. One of the greatest American stage musicals. Movie's yeah. kind of overdone and overripe. Here's the story of the movie. Here's the story of West Side Story. Book, Arthur Lawrence, Jew. Lyrics, Stephen Sondheim, Jew. Music, Leonard Bernstein, Jew. Written, conceived, choreographed, and directed by Jerome Robbins, Jew. Screen new director, Steven Spielberg, Jew. Screenwriter of the new movie, Tony Kushner, Jew. Okay? There is no way that this thing is going to win any awards because it is an act of cultural appropriation.
The fix is in.
By the colonialist monsters who are oppressing the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. So she shouldn't have apologized because it's not going to help. There is no escape. There is no way out. The Jews have stolen the Puerto Rican story in West Side Story, and they will be punished. You mark my words.
The guys on 4chan are going to love this episode.
Sorry.
So, Victorino, I want to get your
yes.
I want to ask you about your opinions, but
and I have questions for John too. But go ahead.
Very
oh,
quickly.
My opinions. Well, okay. So the quadrants.
No, but hold on. One. Yeah. Can, give me a second here, because there were two dueling pieces about In the Heights, which really sort of made my head spin. The first was the review in the New York Times, which I think did a pretty good job of enumerating all of the problems with the film, sort of qua film, and then basically said, but you have to like it. If you don't like it, you're a bad person. And at the same time, The New Yorker has a piece about it, which basically admits that they like the movie, but then says that you can't like it because if you like it, you're a bad person because of all the erasure stuff. And there's this weird thing on the
where
cultural
does Sonny,
left.
Where does Sonny fit into this?
That's a good question.
Into this calculation.
I don't know, but there's this weird thing in the cultural left where but it's everything is meta. Like, you know, like nobody's engaging with the work itself qua work. It's all about how what sort of whether
the
you're a
takes.
Good person
all
or a bad
takes.
Person.
Yeah, that's
for,
right.
And it's there.
That's why we're here.
Like I said, I didn't love. I
that's
didn't,
why we're
I didn't
here to give the actual take.
So,
on
Sonny, what did you think?
Okay,
because
you
like musicals.
I do
you're
like musicals,
sucker.
John. I've seen musicals. You know, it's very easy to take the New Jersey Transit bus
TKTS.
Up to the city to what?
TKTS.
Yes. So, and
John, what did you, as growing up, how did you think about the people like the Mattis family who would stand online at the TKTS?
Oh, TKM, because they're great.
Did you guys look down on them?
I stood in that line. How do you think I went to the theater?
Oh, I thought that was only the Bridge and Tunnel people who did that.
God no! Like no.
My aunt would do it. She preferred it that way because then you don't. Then it's very exciting because you don't know what you're going to see.
Yeah.
Until you get
right.
the ticket.
No.
Great news, we're going to Broadway. Oh, bad news, it's Starlight Express. You know?
no, but
I hope
I mean,
you like roller skates.
When they introduced TKTS when I was, I don't know, 11 or 12 years old, that was how you went to the theater. I don't know. I went by myself mostly, or with friends. Like, my parents didn't buy full price tickets.
Yeah. Yeah,
and now I think about it, the full price ticket was like, I'm not going to pay $12 for Century. What are you, crazy?
To say 42nd
like
Street or something.
$12? That's absurd, you know? It's like, it's, anyway, it's hilarious.
Okay. So what did I think about it? Okay, so I gave the plot a B+. It's understandable, but I really want to know what the plot is, because is it the blackout? Is it the lottery ticket? Or is it like there's a whole I'm moving out feel, isn't it? It's like Billy Joel's I'm moving out. Twyla Tharp, yeah. I'm moving out. Okay, he's getting out of there, but is he really getting out? Okay, duration, as you know, gets an F. Violence action is NA, right? Doesn't apply to this one. Okay. However,
well, no, Victorino, you should, on the violence and action scale, you should be rating like the song and dance numbers.
Had I known,
right? So
I'll
rate,
have to
rate
recalculate
that as action.
Well,
right? So what did you
like?
Think?
Did I like the numbers?
Because I didn't.
Most
I did.
Of them.
I was left mostly cold by it.
No, I'd say I'd say B+. B+. I really like the 96,000 number in the pool, although I agree there could have been more. I would have preferred more. There was a lot of quick cuts, and so I can't really appreciate it, but I still liked it. Sex nudity, I'll give this a C. Why not an F? Because I really like that Melissa Barrera in the 96,000 scene in the bikini. She's great. I just found out this 4th of July she turns 31. So there's the bad news. Anyway, what I didn't like about the movie was the preachiness. I didn't like the preachiness of the player beat me over the head with these things, because of course they didn't when it was
Which
on Broadway
things? About how great America is.
No. So the whole thing about like the Dreamers thing, that wasn't in the original. They had to stick.
No,
that
there
in
were
later.
No Dreamers.
Right,
in
there was no Dreamers when they did that. And then the other thing that really bothered me was the whole Stanford line, you know, about Stanford being racist. And I could think to myself is, who were the racists in the dorm? Were they Japanese, Chinese, or Korean? That's what I want to know. Who is being racist to her? Thank you, John. Thank you. Who's being racist to her? Because that's all there is. I've been to Stanford, you know, and that's pretty much. I just can't. And I wondered, did Lin-Manuel Miranda have something personal? Was there some sort of personal? What's the animus?
Okay, he did not write the screenplay.
Oh, okay.
Kiera Alegría Hudes wrote the screenplay, a 2012 Pulitzer Prize winner for a play so terrible that I can't even remember the name of it. And she is the one who came up with this idiotic dreamer plot that makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
Because the lottery ticket money is eventually used to pay for a lawyer who is going to help Usnavi's
cousin or nephew.
Yeah, pay for... By the way, how did you guys like the Mark Antony?
Thank you, Mark Antony.
Cameo
that was frightening.
As the drunken uncle.
That was frightening.
So Mark Antony has turned into a 50-year-old tattooed anorexic. He is the skinniest.
He's like 90.
Person.
He's like 90 pounds. He's 90 pounds.
I mean, it was hard when I realized that it was Mark Antony. I thought that, you know, like this should be a scene in a horror movie. Like, what?
No, it was shocking.
What happened to Mark Antony?
It was so convincing. Maybe he did it. I think he did it for the role. I don't think that's how he.
No, then I looked him up, and he's been looking like this for years. It's like the guy hasn't.
I don't know. Maybe they did like a Captain America on him.
I need his diet plan. I need his diet plan. Is what I'm saying, because I don't think he's eaten since 2003. Since you know whatever his hits were.
Yeah. So the numbers I did like mostly, but it was way too long. I thought. And so it's like, okay, when is this thing going to end? Did you have the opening, by the way? I felt like it was out of a commercial, like a Crown Royal commercial. And of course, that's Anthony Ramos does the Crown Royal commercial, which he's coming out of walking down the street. Did you think, John, didn't this remind you, is this basically a Dominican Saturday Night Fever? Is that what's happening here?
Because you see him walking down the street to the
and at least for the girl, for Melissa Barrera's character, she wants to get to downtown. Right? She wants that whole other world, a new life in Midtown and whatnot. You know, she wants to escape.
She wants to be a fashion designer.
Yeah.
So as I said, the plot is not the you don't see this for the plot. You mostly don't see most musicals for the plot, but look, if you don't like the numbers, you're not going to like the movie.
That's right.
If you're Sonny and you don't like any numbers, you're not going to like the movie. And look, the truth is people are not interested in this movie. It didn't do well at the box office. Indications are people aren't watching it on HBO Max. And that's interesting because they gave it the good college try. They spent a lot of money on promotion.
They did on marketing, yeah.
And they wanted it to be like the movie that made you want to go back into the theaters. And it turned out that people didn't really want to see it. You know, they wanted to see A Quiet Place.
Yeah.
They'll probably want to see Fast 9. But they didn't want to see this.
People were complaining that one of the problems is the name of the movie or musical is too vague. Do you think that was a problem? Do you think when they saw it in the Heights, they might have thought it was Crown Heights?
Oh, God.
I don't think they've heard of yes. No, I
can't
don't think
Victorino.
No. Yeah.
No, Jackson Heights, Seaside Heights. I don't know.
I don't know. The titles never... There's no such thing as there are some bad titles. Like there was a movie in the 70s called The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh. That's a bad title, right? It's about a basketball team that starts planning its schedule based on astrological signs and starts winning. That's a bad title.
That's a bad night. Okay.
The Fish in the Heights is not a bad title. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, I mean, is West Side Story a good title? It could be the worst, the most generic title ever. It's just, you know, people like West Side Story, so they don't mind the title. I don't think titles really matter all that much.
I do have a couple other questions. JVM, if you don't mind, may I ask John these questions?
Please.
Okay, John, question. Are dry cleaners really that expensive? $9 a shirt? What?
Yes, no, that was it wasn't even a shirt. It was like a pillowcase or a napkin or something like that. Mm-hmm. I would say No, I don't think dry cleaners are that expensive. This was, again, a weird effort to shoehorn in a gentrification plot. To politicize this, and that was really unnecessary. Because also the notion that the neighborhood is being destroyed because the livery cab company is being driven out of business by a dry cleaner. Like, it's one thing if it were being driven out of business by a Walmart or something like that, you know.
But a high-end,
you know,
dry cleaner, environmentally
friendly. Yeah, or like an expensive restaurant, you know. Yes. But like, a dry cleaner, really? That's like a lower-rent business than running a livery cab company.
All right, now, I know we're hitting the wall, as they say. Okay. So really quickly, blackout is a big thing in New York City. Yes. Question.
There has not been a blackout since 2003.
Question. Where were you in the blackout of 77?
Oh boy.
You know this story, right?
Keep it short. You got to keep it short. Yeah, but keep it short. You got to keep it short.
I was standing in front of my apartment building on 105th and Broadway with a baseball bat. I was 16 years old, and I and about 12 other guys who lived in my building stood in front on the corner with baseball bats while looters destroyed the stores across the street.
You were standing next to John.
So you were like the Hell's Angels, right? Did you have the little red berets?
I was terrified.
He was next to Curtis Sliwa.
Bat.
He was him and Curtis Sliwa.
Yes, it was me and Curtis. That's right. It was me and future New York Mayor Curtis Sliwa. Yes, exactly. No, it was me and Art Weinstein, the real estate lawyer. That's the only other guy I remember being there was Art Weinstein. So, you know, we were a phalanx. We were the...
You held your ground.
We held our... But people did not come to our corner. They stayed on the other side of the street. So.
And lastly, do you have any memory of the big blackout of 65?
I do.
What's the one memory you have?
Memory I have is that my sister Naomi went into a bedroom and made out with our friend Dan Jacobson's son Julian. Naomi was like 14 and Julian was 14, and they took advantage of the blackout to go and have a makeout session in another room while we were all crowded into the dining room with a candle.
Thank you. Thank you. On that note, JVL, do you have any other thoughts? I can't believe we're at hour four here.
No, this has been the best. I will say one thing that occurred to me while watching it hit me, one of the reasons that I don't like filmed musicals, and it's this weird fourth wall thing. You know, you're watching a filmed production like this, and the actors are not only are they singing and dancing, which is weird and not something that happens in life, but they're staring right at you. They're looking right into the camera while they're doing, and that makes sense when it is live because they are performing for an audience. When it's like, it's just weird. It's literally breaking the fourth wall in ways that I find off-putting.
Really, really great musicals do not have that. Like, that is actually one of the... When you have a genuinely great musical director like Stanley Donen, who directed these movies with Gene Kelly.
Right.
People say these movies were directed by Gene Kelly and Stanley Donen. Stanley Donen directed them, in my view, because Gene Kelly, when he wasn't with Stanley Donen, made awful, awful movies. And Stanley Donen made good movies when he wasn't with Gene Kelly. But they made Singing in the Rain and On the Town and Anchors Away and It's Always Fair Weather, and Donen made Seven Brides for Seven Brothers and stuff like that, and they always found a way to break focus. Like, it was all the whole thing about dance numbers was they're not like looking off into space, but somehow they always looked a little off center, and so it didn't have that weird effect. It's like, why are you looking at me?
Right.
Stop
but
looking.
Which
at me.
In yeah. Heights has constantly.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Anyway, so that's an interesting, it's an interesting objection. All I'm saying is you suspend disbelief all the time in the course. But I understand why it's weird to watch people start singing and dancing and how that can be disturbing. I just it's, you know, and so everyone has their own tastes and pleasures. Musicals are, next to westerns, are the oldest form of talking picture, and more musicals have won Best Picture Oscars than any other form. And more musicals have made more money than most other forms until the comic book movies came out. This idea that they're like a weird minority taste that only certain strange people have is belied by every statistic we know. They are beloved. They have always been beloved. You know, Chicago made $200 million. Sound of Music is the third most successful movie ever made. Oliver made a trillion dollars. You know, MGM became the number one studio in the world for 20 years, largely built on the backs of musicals. And so it's what I'm saying is I'm insulting Sonny Bunch.
Listened to podcasts, he would take offense at this.
He'll never.
Okay.
Yes.
So Vic, before we get out, I would just say this. What John said was exactly right. Everything is just, do you like the numbers? Right. And if that's the numbers true. Are great, then you like it. And if they aren't, then it isn't. Mm-hmm. I think that 20 years from now, the only thing that will be of interest concerning In the Heights is looking at the ways in which it is the immature work where there are seeds of Hamilton that you can see planted in it.
Uh-huh. And By the way, you made a very important point about Hamilton and the stage show taping, which, by the way, was a secret. You know, nobody knew
that this had been.
No one knew that this had been done. There was this announcement in 2019 that Disney had bought Hamilton and was going to show it at Thanksgiving 20. Was going to release it at Thanksgiving 2020 because secretly, in 2016, over three nights, they had filmed it in the theater. And this was kept a total secret. It's a fascinating story. I don't know why they kept it a secret. And they sold it to Disney for $75 million. This three-night
steal since Marvel
videotape, right? Mm-hmm. And it was, and you're right, that it is an untranslatable experience to film. The first musical that I ever saw, not to bore everybody, though very connected to this, was 1776, which was a show in the 1960s about the writing of the about the weeks leading up to the writing of the and signing of the Declaration of Independence. It's a very strange show. It's a show in which there are no songs for about half an hour. And there are two women in it. They're kind of shoehorned in. Mostly it's men. Mostly it's John Adams and Ben Franklin. And it's mostly about what is going to be done about slavery. I was 7 years old when I saw it. It is a spectacular piece of theater. I've seen it three times since in the theater. It's an incredibly powerful show, and it concludes with the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And as they're signing it, a scrim drops showing the Declaration, you know, like see through, while the clock that has the Liberty Bell in it is ringing, you know, starts chiming 12. And it is a knockout moment. And there is a film version of it, directed by the guy who directed it on Broadway, starring the Broadway cast, that was filmed in Philadelphia and is a full movie version of it. And it is awful. It's incredibly faithful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's terrible because what is great about something theatrical is that it's theatrical. And being theatrical is not good in the movies. The movies operate in a different realm. And so you're exactly right. And I hope they never... It's not going to happen, assuming that there will ever be movies again. At some point, somebody will make a movie out of Hamilton if there are movies that still get made. And that will be bad. It will be bad.
On that note, that has to be all the time we're giving to this episode. Questions, comments, compliments, tweet us at Sonny Butch, at Victor Mattis, at J Podhoritz.
Yes, but I do not. I do not.
Oh, right, I forgot.
Answer. You can tweet me, but I will not answer you.
Again, be sure to subscribe to us on Patreon. Just go to subbeacon.com. We are there. Tell your friends. Until next time. That is a very interesting revelation you had, John, about the connection between musicals and action movies, that interspersed with plot and then scenes that go pop.
I mean, I wrote a piece about this. One of the, you know, I've got to go at some point in the Standard. I wrote this thing about how action would like Singing in the Rain, which is the best movie musical ever made by, you know, a factor of 10,000.
Right.
And everybody agrees with this, has this sort of center section, about 25 minutes, where there are like five production numbers in a row. And by the time the thing is over, you're about to collapse. It's like you can't take it. It's so intense. Like, it's insanely intense. All this stuff is sort of packed in, and it's very much like a James Cameron. It's like
T2 if there's too
or
much,
something.
If there's too much, then it becomes.
But it's like that center section of Terminator 2, where it's just like
relentless.
It just never stops. You know, it's like every scene tops the last scene. And you're like, how is this, you know?
But you know what I was just thinking, though, is, you know what else it applies? Not just to action movies, musicals and actions, but pornos as well. It's just sort of in between.
I knew you were going to say that.
I'm sure. Which kind? which kind? I mean, because if they have a particular focus.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, but I mean, there's like in between with plot. I'm just in between. There's a little plot and then there's more action. But then they move around. JVL.
I'm sure it's fine.